Hi, I'm Alicia Atchison. I'm vegan, an animal lover, and animal rights activist. Many people say that becoming vegan is one of the best decisions they have made in life. I'm here to share my guest stories on their choice to live a kind life and what it means for them to be vegan.
Welcome to A Kind Life. Today I'm joined by Dr. Holly Sitters. How are you going, Holly?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Alicia.
Thank you so much for being here. So we actually know each other outside of the podcast world. For a couple of years now, we've both been involved in the Animal Justice Party in regional groups. And I'm really excited to have you on because I only kind of know a bit of your political journey, not so much about like your career and even your vegan journey. So thank you for coming on today.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, no, definitely my pleasure. So please tell us a little bit about yourself, Holly.
Sure. So I live in Ballarat with my partner and our three dogs. As you can probably tell from my accent, I grew up in the UK. So I moved to Australia when I was about 23, which means that I've been here for all like 18 years or so now. I don't know where the time has gone. And so my day job, I'm an ecologist and I work with a national conservation NGO. And so a lot of what I do is focused on saving threatened species, mainly threatened animals. And also I'm particularly interested in looking at sort of early warning signs of decline in the more common species so that we can act before it's too late. And so I feel really grateful to be able to work in the world of, you know, saving animals. But the flip side is that in this country, whenever you're focused on saving native species, it sort of involves waging war on introduced species, which as a vegan, of course, is extremely challenging. And I'm still sort of figuring out how to navigate that space. Outside of work and animal activism, I have like a bunch of hobbies that I just feel like I never really have enough time to spend on. So I love traveling. I wish I had more time and money, as does virtually all of us. Love reading, try to read a little bit every day. Love photography, but tend to do that more sort of when I'm on holiday or when it's a little sunnier outside. And I try to, you know, exercise as much as I can, meditate a little bit. But yeah, there's just always that feeling of not quite enough time to kind of do all the things that I would love to be able to do.
I think that's a common occurrence in most of us. Like we tend to like have a job and then outside of that is a lot of focus on animals, whether it be like activism or our own animals. And then you always think you've got these high hopes for integrating some balance, but it doesn't always happen. So good on you for trying.
Yeah, trying. Sometimes I succeed, you know, but it's like you've just got to focus on the small wins, haven't you? And just accept the fact that those big chunks of time to sort of do whatever, like read a book, you know, they're probably not gonna come anytime soon. But yeah, accepting that it definitely takes time and practice, I think.
So what made you move to Australia?
Interesting question. So I suppose actually, it started with The Flying Doctors, which I'm not sure if you've heard of it. It's an Australian TV show that was quite popular in the 80s. And so I watched The Flying Doctors and I was captivated by those big wide open spaces. You know, the UK, I suppose it's comparatively crowded. The weather, of course, isn't great. I was really lucky because my parents loved Australia too. And I managed to come over here for the first time when I was about 14. And we had this incredible trip over the school holidays, starting up in Broome, where we spent a week, and then traveling through the Kimberley, the top end, down through the Northern Territory, South Australia, ending up in Melbourne. And so, of course, to me, that was absolutely incredible. You know, the wildlife, again, the wide open spaces, the people. I just absolutely love this country. And since then, I suppose I was pretty hell-bent on moving here, which, again, I was pretty naive. I had no idea what such a move would involve. I sort of wanted to come here to study at university, but it just wasn't possible. So I went to university in Edinburgh in Scotland and ended up meeting an Australian man. And so I came over here after university and to cut a long story short, ended up becoming a permanent resident. But it took about 8 years of sort of different visas and, you know, a very, very big process. And I've been fortunate to call Australia home, you know, for quite a while now, and I've got dual citizenship. So feel very, very grateful to, you know, be in this country. I think certainly in the world of conservation, there are far more opportunities than there are in the UK.
So when you were studying back home, were you studying ecology?
I was. I think I was influenced by my dad. So he is a birdo. sort of borderline twitcher, which again, as a kid on family holidays, you know, my dad and to some extent my mom would be very keen on, you know, looking at the birds and finding some rare species, which again, I wasn't particularly, I was more into the swimming pools and the beaches. So I certainly wasn't a birdo from a young age, but I think, you know, I went on quite a few sort of field trips with him to a range of places in the UK and also in Australia. And I guess that over time that, you know, that had a very strong influence on me. And that was what caused me to sort of choose that direction. But again, in hindsight, it wasn't, I didn't feel sort of really strongly that that was what I wanted to do. But at the time, you know, it was, yeah, it's very difficult, I think, at that age, isn't it? When you're making these decisions and you don't know how they're going to influence the direction of your life. So I sort of went with it. And yeah, I definitely don't have any regrets.
And so when you came out of university, like what was your kind of first place of employment?
It was actually the Broome Bird Observatory. So my partner at the time and I sort of ran it for 2.5 years. So it's owned and run by BirdLife Australia, and it's a sort of an ecotourism facility. So there is accommodation, a small campground, it's involved in a little bit of research. And it was, for me, as the first sort of job out of uni, it was awesome because I got to be involved in just so many different sorts of, you know, aspects of running a business. And yeah, it sort of ranged, I guess what I did ranged from, you know, cleaning toilets to doing the accounting for the bird observatory, organizing these sort of educational courses for tourists that came to visit. So yeah, it was, we spent about, 2.5 years there. And again, it was an incredible, incredible place to be and to live. You know, Roebuck Bay is absolutely phenomenal. It's sort of number one shorebird destination. So it's sort of, yeah, the birdo's paradise. And again, I still wouldn't have called myself a birdo at that time, but I loved animals and I loved wildlife, and it's really spectacular up there.
So when you moved from the UK to Australia, the first place you lived was Broome.
It was.
Wow, yes. That's high expectations, I feel.
Yeah. It's funny. Like in some ways, I guess it did feel like living in a bit of a bubble. You're so, so isolated up there. You know, the nearest big city is Perth, which is a 4-hour flight or whatever. So that aspect of it was quite confronting, I suppose, having, you know, grown up in the UK and everything. But yeah, absolutely stunning. The Kimberley, I guess, is probably my favorite part of the world. It's just incredibly beautiful up there. A couple of years up there, and then we ended up in Alice Springs for a couple of years, and then finally in Ballarat, where I've been for like 13 years, which I used to think of myself as somebody who travels around a lot, but now I've been here for 13 years, you know, I can't really say that anymore.
Yeah. And so what other like organizations have you worked for? So you obviously left the conservatory, and then where have you sort of gone until you've got to this point?
So I when I was in Broome, I became interested in justice for First Nations people. Again, I had very little understanding, I suppose, of all those issues at that time, and I became very interested in that, and so ended up getting a job with an Aboriginal organisation in Alice Springs, and I was involved in community development for a couple of years there. So focused on sustainable livelihoods that allow people to live on country. And that was an incredible experience for me. You know, I learned so much, but I also found it very challenging because I found that it was very difficult to make real progress and real change and improve people's lives. And I have immense respect for people who work in that field for decades. And it's just, you know, you're just up against so many immense challenges. So I had really enjoyed doing my honours project when I was in Edinburgh, an ecological project, you know, so I thought, well, maybe I'll try and, you know, go back to ecology. And so I applied to do a PhD at Melbourne Uni, and I was really just sort of lucky that it all happened. I didn't quite realise at the time how lucky I was, because again, I think it's becoming increasingly difficult, you know, funding for that sort of thing is just becoming increasingly squeezed. And so I think my timing was really fortunate. And so, yeah, we ended up moving down to Victoria. And so I was based at the Creswick campus of Melbourne Uni, which is a rural campus about 15 minutes drive from Ballarat. So that's why I ended up in Ballarat.
Wow, you've had such a like different, like varying experiences, which is really cool. Like it's obviously led you to this point. So how long have you worked for the current NGO that you're at?
Only a year. So I did my PhD at Melbourne Uni and then got a job as a research fellow in the same sort of lab group. So that was focused on fire ecology. So the effects of planned fire and wildfire on biodiversity and, you know, how we can sort of use fire to help fauna. So I was at Melbourne Uni for 12 years altogether. And again, I guess mainly driven by sort of funding being squeezed, I ended up looking for other opportunities. And so I've worked with this NGO for, it's almost exactly a year now. And it's actually a work from home job. So I'm on a national science team involved in coordinating the research and monitoring that happens at different sanctuaries across the country.
Wow.
So it's I'm learning so much, I guess, about different ecosystems, different species. I had become quite parochial, I guess. A lot of what I did was very Victorian centric. And so it has been, you know, fantastic to just read and learn and fill my mind with information about, you know, northern quolls and brush-tailed bettongs and all these animals that occur across the country.
I mean, I know this is not quite relevant, but I guess in my personal experience, like where I studied environmental management, and at that time, like the degree was so large, there's so much involved, like there's so many different aspects that like it's almost like overwhelming, like exactly what you're talking about, where, you know, there would have been, you've always kind of like, I suppose, specialized in what you've been interested in. But then when you try to branch out a little bit, there's just so much to learn, which is great because, you know, we don't want to become stale and not, you know, not sort of know new things. But I guess it also would have been a bit of a challenge for you moving into, a different area after 12 years.
Yeah, that's right. Like I think it definitely came at the right time. I'd sort of started to branch out a little bit at Melbourne Uni. So I was very focused on, you know, fire quite some time, and then started to work on a project that looked at the combined effects of fire and habitat fragmentation. So, you know, fire may affect species in one way and fragmentation affects them in another way, but how do they act together? So just looking at how different threats interact. Yeah, again, and again, there's just so much that we don't know, and I feel this sense of urgency given the climate crisis and the biodiversity extinction crisis to sort of gain a better understanding as to some of these problems. And yet, it's extremely challenging because it is extremely resource intensive. You know, research, it's very expensive, and often, of course, other things are prioritized as they should be. And yet, you know, we all value our native wildlife.
And so for you, I guess, like, where has that kind of intersected, like, your career and then, like, your activism? Like, in this movement, we tend to focus more on farmed animal species, but I'm guessing, you know, for you, at different stages, you've brought across your knowledge and it's kind of intersected there and you've been able to bring those two together?
Yeah, I've sort of been trying to figure out how best to do that, I suppose. I find it's a tricky sort of balancing act, I guess, because there is this notion that scientists shouldn't be advocates. I've heard this a lot, and, you know, I guess I dispute that fairly strongly, because I think as scientists we all have values. We're all humans. We value biodiversity. You know, all ecologists value natural systems and biodiversity. And so I think that as the scientific community, we need to just shed this idea that we're sort of neutral and objective and unbiased. I was in Darwin at the Ecological Society of Australia conference, and one of the keynote speakers, a very, very eminent Australian ecologist, said himself that he thought that it was time that we became advocates. And that was just music to my ears, because, you know, we really do need to throw caution to the wind, I guess, and just get out there and start to fight for what we value and what we believe in, rather than sort of sitting back and letting activists do that work. And so as an activist and a scientist, again, I certainly don't feel like I have come to a clear way forward. So yeah, it's very challenging. I'm sort of trying to use my professional skills in a way that will benefit the species that I care so much about, while also ensuring that I don't lose that sort of scientific credibility, because there is, again, that just that strong notion in science that, you know, we should be unemotional and all this, which doesn't go hand in hand with the way I feel as an activist, which is, you know, I care very, very passionately about all animals, all living beings.
Yeah. And I'm guessing, you know, this is maybe slightly controversial, so feel free, we don't have to cover the question, but I guess, like, I had spoken previously to Adam Cardellini as well, and he was saying, you know, I guess there's this, I'm always just so intrigued about how you manage that kind of thing of, like, some of your peers, I'm assuming, you know, very passionate about saving species, but may not have kind of, you know, found that link between animal agriculture and, like, climate change, or, you know, the loss of species, for example. So I'm guessing for yourself, that would be quite challenging sometimes, like in the workplace or in within your peers. Like, that's that topic that you
very
want to bring
much
up.
So.
Yeah, you want to bring it up, but you don't.
Yeah, very, very much so. I sort of, soon after I became vegan, which was about 7 years ago, initially I sort of really couldn't handle that. Like, I couldn't handle those conversations. I was just so, I'd watched Dominion and I was just full of emotion, and I, you know, I found it all tremendously upsetting. So I just did really, you know, I just stood way back, and I didn't attempt to have any conversations. I just avoided, I even avoided going to conferences and things like that, because I found it really difficult to be around, you know, groups of people who are advocating for all these things related to the environment, but also eating meat for lunch. And, you know, it's very, very challenging. So I have changed a lot. I think that, you know, we're all on a journey, aren't we? And so fortunately nowadays, I am much better able to, I suppose, you know, stay clearly attached to what I believe in. I am still pretty reticent. You know, I just feel really worried that if I sort of go in too strong with my messages, that people are just going to stop listening. So I tread very cautiously, sometimes probably too cautiously. But again, just sort of, I'm on that journey of trying to figure out what works best and how I can, you know, best help the animals.
And where, like, at what point was that connection made for you? You said you've been vegan for 7 years.
Yeah, it's I sort of feel like my vegan story is, it's not very neat. Like, I wish I could just say I watched a documentary and then I became vegan and that was it. Unfortunately, it wasn't sort of clear like that. So yeah, when I was in primary school, I was always disgusted by the idea of eating animal flesh. For some reason, it was just sort of innate in me. So I went to this school, which I remember as being quite strict. And we had school dinners, and we were told to eat everything that was on our plate. And at the time, it never occurred to me that I could sort of say no thank you, which is, again, it's interesting. I think that kids are more assertive these days. And, you know, dietary requirements are common and they are respected, but certainly there was nothing like that when I was at school in the 80s. And so my strategy was to, it's a little pathetic, but I would, like, line up the pieces of meat and then hide them under my knife. So I sort of did my best to avoid it. But it wasn't until I left primary school, and then we had more choices at high school, that I consider myself vegetarian. I asked my mum whether this was her recollection of how things went. And she said that it was when I was 8 that I said that I didn't want to eat meat anymore. And she was, yeah, I hadn't remembered that. But my mum, my dad, they were fantastic. I was extremely lucky, because my mom, again, she told me that she was at the time sort of learning to cook herself, and cooked a lot of vegetables and rice and pasta, and that it wasn't difficult for her just to modify that and pull out the meat. So I was super lucky to have supportive parents in that way. And so, yeah, I then remained vegetarian for a long time. It was quite a big part of my identity. You know, I considered myself a cheese lover and couldn't live without cheese, all that stuff. And I think I had all those sort of barriers around my head that prevented any information that might make me, you know, feel uncomfortable about the whole cheese eating thing come in. And so, yeah, there was really no clear event that caused me to turn vegan. When I was PhD student at Melbourne Uni, we went on this postgraduate conference to the Dookie campus, which is an agricultural college near Shepparton. And we were taken to see this sort of dairy showpiece. It was some kind of, I don't know, new innovative way of milking. And I found that really confronting. Like, there was no cruelty, but just the way that the cows were treated like robots, I found that really disturbing. And that clearly played on my mind, because then start of 2017, I just sort of randomly decided to turn vegan. It's really strange, and it's not satisfying, because you know how it is. If you understand your own story, then you can use that to help other people perhaps perhaps become vegan. And so I became vegan, and then because I suppose all those psychological barriers melted away, I started reading about how meat and dairy were produced. And I just filled my brain with all this stuff. Like, I read some brilliant, brilliant books, quite a few of them. You know how it is when you suddenly become really interested in something, it's like amazing how much you can read. One book by Melanie Joy, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, Wear Cows. Like, you know, that was very eye-opening to me at the time. Mercy for Animals by Nathan Runkle. That was, again, a lot about how Farm Transparency Project operates in Australia. So going undercover and, you know, showing the public what happens behind the scenes. Again, that was extremely eye-opening. And also Farmageddon by Philip Limbury. So more the environmental impacts of dairy and meat. And so this sort of thirst for knowledge culminated in my watching Dominion. I was on a work trip in Adelaide, and so I watched it in the cinema. And it was good that I was in the cinema, because I never would have made it to the end otherwise. I just had tears streaming down my face after about 10 minutes. And it completely changed my life, because I just turned from a vegan to an activist overnight. You know, you just can't sort of watch that and just sit back and let that happen. So I just started googling like local animal rights people and found the Animal Justice Party.
I could only imagine. It's funny how there's little, and I find it interesting that some people do say that, you know, they're like, oh, there wasn't like one moment I wish I had this story. But I think, like, you know, it's great to hear that there was little like seeds, you know, that were obviously being planted along the way, and there's just something for you clicked it, and you were like, no, that's, you know, that's it for me, and from this point forward you're vegan. So that's incredible.
Yeah, it's funny, that sort of just creeping awareness at the back of your mind. It's sort of almost subconscious. But yeah, it's again, I guess it does inspire me to just keep planting those seeds. Yeah. And often it's the, I don't know, several hundred seed or something that's when somebody will make the change.
Exactly. And so tell us about how you got involved in the Animal Justice Party.
Yeah, so I just, did some Googling, found out that about the local meeting, turned up, and like, oh my goodness, thank goodness I did, because, you know, they are the most amazing people, and I really haven't looked back. Like, I think I would have gone completely crazy if I hadn't met those people when I did. You know, it's just this sort of sense of community. You really do feel like having watched Dominion, you know, having suddenly woken up to the state of things, it is just like you just dumped on another planet overnight, and the way that you had seen everything is just suddenly transformed, and the people around you don't really see it, and you know, you're trying to explain, but of course it's just not that easy. It's just not a matter of explaining to all the people that you know what you've learned, and you know, suddenly they will change with you. I mean, of course occasionally that happens, but it's often not the way it works.
Do you place like a value on bringing about like change for animals through the political system? Like, did you ever have interest in politics before knowing about AJP, I guess?
I think whichever group of people had been active in Ballarat at that time, you know, for the interests of animals, I would have been there. So it was really a matter of coincidence that was the Animal Justice Party. I certainly didn't have any prior in particular interest in politics. And so, you know, now I guess I have come to see it all differently. It is clearly an extremely effective vehicle for change for animals, but I certainly don't see it as the way. You know, I think that a whole bunch of different ways are sort of needed if we are to create the vegan world that we all so want to see.
I think, you know, like it's cool that you found that community, and then it's kind of, yeah, I guess you could say, well, I'm assuming here that you would say it's like brought you out into your shell. It was the first thing that you found, and then you've kind of like that's allowed you to find other people and communities and groups and things that you can be involved in.
Yeah, absolutely. Us group of AJP members in the Ballarat region, you know, certainly before COVID, we went to quite a few different activities and, you know, forms of activism in Melbourne and Geelong, as well as in Ballarat. And so although we were all AJP members, and that's how we, you know, we met and became friends, we were involved in a whole bunch of different things. COVID has definitely changed things, it's been a challenge, and I think we're still recovering in a way. I think that there was this sort of collective loss of energy, you know, certainly in Ballarat and in other places as well, I'm sure. And so we're gradually pulling together that energy again, but yeah, we're not quite there yet.
Was this your first state election or second that you've run in as a candidate for AJP?
Yeah, it was my first. I think the previous one must have been quite soon after I joined, and I certainly didn't feel, you know, it's one of those things that sounds really intimidating when you're sort of new to everything. But I volunteered for so Bryn Hills was our regional group leader for the Animal Justice Party here in Ballarat for a long time. So he founded the group here, and he was just amazing. He was candidate in, you know, as many elections as he could possibly be, even though that often meant resigning from his job, you know, such that he could stand. And so he did so much, and it was always quite difficult sort of finding other people to stand as well. And because I'm a dual citizen, I'm not eligible to stand for the federal election. And so by the time this recent state election came up, you know, I was so ready. I was sort of desperate, I guess, to contribute and, yeah, step out of my comfort zone as well. So, yeah.
How did you find the experience?
I really loved it, I guess. Yeah, I sort of really threw myself into it. And in some way, I surprised myself by how much I was capable of. Like, I was just, you know, working around the clock and really enjoying it. Like, I've never been into social media, as in I've never really contributed much to social media at all. But again, through that campaign, and, you know, it's all about the animals, really. Like, even though it was a political campaign and everything, you know, I just saw it as an opportunity to help spread our message, help animals. And so I just got really into social media. Unfortunately, I haven't kept that going since the election. But yeah, it was also just a great time to recruit more, you know, volunteers for us. So yes, it was a super exciting time. Really, really enjoyed it. And yeah, I mean, I learned so much. I think I would struggle to actually be a politician. I'm looking at what Georgie Purcell, our amazing MP, is doing now. And oh my goodness, I think I would like be exhausted after a month of that. But, you know, it's phenomenal what she's doing, and anything I can do to sort of support the general, you know, the movement through the Animal Justice Party, I'm there.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, isn't it? Like, it seems like quite daunting, but then once you're in it, like, it's good that, you know, you kind of found your feet and were able to run with it. And like you said, it's really about, you know, obviously we wanted to get at least one, if not two. We're hoping for Andy to return as an MP. But
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot of hard work, but definitely for great reason. And like you said, like, learned a lot. Like, I think everyone that was involved definitely learned a lot. We sort of thrown into it and learned as we went.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I sort of, you know, I'm excited for the next opportunity. And currently, yeah, just focused on trying to build up our numbers in this region so that, you know, next time the election comes around, we can hit it even harder and again just share all those vital messages about what we stand for.
I guess that's what I wanted to ask you as well, is, you know, how do you think that, yeah, the Ballarat and like kind of that part of Western Victoria region, like, kind of, I suppose, finds AJP? Like, did you find that you got some good support, like, when you're at polling booths and part of the campaign?
Yeah, it was fantastic, actually. So I was done as a candidate in the Ripon electorate, which encompasses couple of the more regional towns, so Maryborough and Ararat. And a lot of people, so we hadn't run an active campaign in Ripon before. And a lot of people had said to me, oh, you know, you're brave standing in this, you know, farming country. And I was thinking, I'm not brave. I didn't realize I was really going to be dealing with this. And so, yeah, we're pretty worried, I think, the first time we hit the booths with the AJP how to vote cards. But it was, I would say, an almost overwhelmingly positive response. Of course, most people just walk right by in the same way they do in the bigger cities. There were a very small number of more difficult interactions, but overall really, really pleasantly surprised. And if I were to stand in Ripon again, I would not feel any fear. So I guess, yeah, the only thing that does still instill a little fear in me is the community forums, where you're up there with the other candidates and you're fielding questions from the public. I mean, that's a challenge, because again, as animal rights activists, you know, we're of course very focused on the animals, the animal issues, you know, to some extent the environmental issues. But the range of issues and questions that can be launched at you in those forums, that's pretty scary. I think, again, for me, so through my work, you know, I used to be terrified of public speaking, and I gradually became more comfortable with it through practice. But again, in the professional sphere, you just have this sort of cushion of, like, I don't know, scientific information behind you. And it's sort of, yeah, to go out there feeling completely unprepared about, you know, potholes and what's a good response. That was like the big issue that everybody in Ripon cared about, was the potholes. You know, how do we respond to that effectively and speak for the animals? And again, quite a different way of thinking, I think. So
yeah,
I really need to start practicing those responses, I think, in time for the next election.
You've got a few years, so you've got some time.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you were recently involved. There was an inquiry into recreational shooting of native water birds. So it was ducks and also quail. And I guess a lot of people who would listen to this were quite aware of that, you know, the inquiry, and that we had as the general members of the public, we had the ability to put in submissions. And then there was a number of hearings as part of that inquiry. And you were actually called up as an ecologist. So in the professional sense, you were called up as someone to provide some information and feedback. Like, tell us about that experience.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. So I guess my only previous experience of something like this was, there was the inquiry into ecosystem decline and biodiversity loss in Victoria, probably 3 years ago the inquiry happened. And so that was my first go, I guess, at appearing at one of these parliamentary hearings. While that was pretty scary at the time, it was nothing compared to the duck inquiry. Yeah, the inquiry into ecosystem decline, I suppose, you know, there was this general sense, you know, we're losing these ecosystems, that's not great. Whereas in the duck inquiry, of course, it's you're either for banning hunting or not. And so it's very, very polar opposites. And I was there, again, as an ecologist, focused on declines and how the fact that hunting ducks poses a threat and that we have an opportunity here to remove a threat. And so, yeah, I was there as an ecologist. But of course, I have a strong, strong motivation here, which is the suffering of the individuals. You know, that's the primary thing for me. If it causes suffering, let's just stop it. But I thought that, you know, I could use my ecological skills to hopefully help the ducks. And yeah, I did what I could do. It was definitely stepping out of my comfort zone. I was pretty intimidated by the duck shooters who were sitting nearby, you know, but it was an experience. And yeah, it was pretty tough, I gotta say. Like, the general format of these inquiries, I suppose, I guess what I came out of that thinking, perhaps a neutral and independent committee might be best placed to interview witnesses, because it was pretty clear that, you know, the committee members, of course, they either want to see an end to duck shooting or they don't. And so they just sort of want you to say things that will support their view. Again, like, there's not much training available to prepare for that kind of thing. So yeah, it was a challenging experience. But again, you know, I'm motivated by the suffering that these many, many hundreds of thousands of birds are facing every year. So that's what I keep in mind.
They provide any prior like questions or anything that you were able to kind of like prepare on, or was it just sort of like open? They could ask you anything when you arrived on the day.
Yeah, it was completely open. You're not given any prior information apart from you're told that you can make an opening statement, which is, you know, just a very short, it was only 5 minutes, a short sort of speech, I guess, as to your position. And then it was almost an hour of questions, which again, I gotta say, struck me as quite a long time because, you know, I'm an ecologist, I'm interested in species declines, how we can help them. I'm not a duck focused person. So yeah, like what, you know, I think the principles that apply to the situation with ducks applies to pretty much all native species in this country. You know, it applies to kangaroos as well. The way that we are out there shooting vast numbers of kangaroos every day, it really does appall me. Of course, from the perspective of the suffering of the individuals, but also the fact that we are in an extinction crisis. And there are just so many things that we don't know about the climate crisis and exactly how it's going to play out and when, and exactly how it's going to influence, you know, other threats. Like, of course, we have an idea that it's going to increase the frequency and intensity of wildfires, but we don't know, you know, exactly how and exactly when and how that will influence animals like kangaroos. So to be out there now shooting them, needless to say, just not a good idea.
I'm imagining it would have been really difficult to remain like, yeah, to not have an emotional response to some of the things that were thrown at you.
Yeah, I sort of seem to, I don't know what happens, but I sort of seem to numb myself in a way. Yeah, it's difficult to describe, but I'm sort of like, it's like you're in this sort of survival mode. You're just trying to survive, like going from one question to the next. And yeah, it's all a bit of a weird blur.
Yeah, no, I think we're very lucky, you know, having that knowledge and obviously being someone that is passionate about animals, whether it be, you know, wildlife or I hate the word introduced species, but
it's, farmed it's animals. Better though than invasive species or feral species. Like there's just so, yeah, there's so many really, really gruesome terms, aren't there?
Yeah. Like, I think we're so lucky to have you. Yeah, like, because obviously we're all quite passionate, but you bring in this, you know, huge layer of knowledge and expertise that is able to, like you said, you're trying to, I suppose, balance being an activist and a scientist. But it's fantastic that we, you know, we have people like yourself that are providing the background knowledge and information that then, you know, enables us to do things like, you know, I'm sure that you put in like submissions for other things as well, like the kangaroo culling and inverted commas. So it's great that, you know, we can as a movement, but also as the AJP, that we have some of that knowledge as well.
Oh, thanks, Alicia. Yeah, I sort of feel like, again, we're quite a diverse group of people from, you know, all walks of life and so many different professions and so many different skills, many creative skills, like so many, I know so many incredibly creative people through, you know, activism, and it's that kind of diversity and that combination of things, isn't it, coming together, which I think is really powerful and effective. Albeit there's always that sense like we need more, you know, more quickly, but still, like it's an amazing, amazing group of people.
Yeah, I know, we always feel like we don't have enough, do we? You need more people, more bodies, more knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. It's hard.
So is there anything that I guess you're working on or focusing on over the rest of this year or into next year that you wanted to chat about?
The main thing is just sort of building up our energies in this region. So yeah, I've been the regional group leader for Ballarat since the start of this year. And again, just sort of continuing on from what our incredible, incredible Bryn Hills was doing, who is still very actively involved in the group as well. Just trying to, yeah, just build up the energies, which, you know, we're still not quite where we were pre-COVID, but we're getting there. I've got a, you know, a fantastic team, and we're arranging quite a diverse range of different events because, of course, different things appeal to different people. So we have working bees at a local sanctuary. We had a protest for the kangaroos in town a couple of months ago, which was awesome. Again, it was our first protest since COVID, so that was really exciting. And we've also got an art show organized for November. So if you know, a few things happening and gradually sort of building up our energies again. And I guess personally, I haven't really talked to anybody about this. I'm kind of a bit shy about it, but because of this art show, I thought I really want to contribute to the art show. And so I've started like trying to draw a bit and all these things, which I haven't done since I was about 12. I'm trying. It's really early days. I'm really hoping that I'll be able to produce something that I won't mind being in the public by November, but we'll see.
Is there a theme or is it open to anything?
So the art show, it's sort of animal rights, but intersectional as well. So again, currently I'm just focusing on like how to use the pencil and stuff. So I haven't really thought of exactly what I might do. But
you've got a few months. You've got some time.
Yeah, that's right. Currently I'm sort of practicing on my dog, Charlie, who, you know, is like the love of my life. So Charlie is getting drawn a lot at the moment, with, you know, lesser and greater success. So
you did mention as well that obviously you're a bit of a travel enthusiast, given time, money and all the resources. So I guess, do you have anything planned in the next 12 months for travel?
So the only thing that we have planned is actually a bit of a road trip. So because I'm working for a national organization and I spend a lot of time reading about the different sanctuaries across the country, going on a bit of a road trip sort of partly as a holiday up to Central Australia and partly to visit some of these places that I spend all this time reading about. So, you know, they're places that I've been before a few times, but, you know, this is such an incredible country. I could never get bored of making that sort of trip. So it'll be a camping trip just in Australia this year. But yeah, I'm often thinking about travel plans, but that's the only thing which is sort of booked in. Yeah.
I don't want to add to your list, but I really feel like now I should also then throw in the challenge of include some social media as part of that trip so that we all can, you know, look on, you know, Jealousy from Home and see where you are and what you're up to. And also, you know, like promote some of the places that you're actually doing work for would be really cool to see.
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, just discovering that I actually really enjoyed contributing to social media during the election it's been playing on my mind. Like I really should get back on there and, you know, postings mainly, of course, related to animals and activism, but yeah, the odd like great scenery, it definitely can't hurt, can it?
Well, yeah, I hope to see that, but I don't want to add to your long list of things to do. Well, thank you so much, Holly. Is there anything that we might have missed that you did want to mention before we finish up?
I don't think so, Alicia. It has been wonderful talking to you. I have really enjoyed it.
I know. I feel like we've covered a lot and it's been incredible. Like I said, I knew there was going to be things that I didn't know about you that, you know, and I never knew why you came to Australia. So there you go. That's been a huge insight into your journey so far. So thank you so much, Holly. It was really fantastic to catch up and look forward to seeing what you've got coming up in the next 12 months.
Thanks so much, Alicia.
Take care, lovely. Thank you.
See ya.
Thanks for joining us today. I would love to hear from you if you've been inspired by this episode or if you have any requests for future episodes. You can find me on Instagram at akindlife. Remember, be kind to your body, kind to animals, and kind to our planet. Take care.